Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, June 6th, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is Christian Sharon. Today's session number is 98.5, and it's titled Worship and Ethics, the Hidden Language of Gesture and Movement. Let's listen in.
This is the last session of a week-long session on worship and ethics, and this session is entitled The Hidden Language of Gesture and Movement. And what I've done this week is to set this proposal for conversation before the group each day, in order for liturgy to form us well in the practices of faith, we must learn the hidden languages of worship. Now let me spend just a few minutes introducing myself and introducing this statement in the books that I've used to put this together. And then after that introductory moment, then what we'll do for the session is consider together where in our culture gesture and movement are important. And one of the convictions I have is that our culture is very powerfully formative. And so I want to think about ways in which we typically gesture and move in our everyday lives, in our society, not only as individuals, but how we do that in ways together. And then think about, where do gesture and movement play a role in our worship life? And then in conclusion, we'll ask the question, if we think carefully about gesture and movement, will that help us in practicing our faith well? And I'll ask the group to think about which of these practices or other practices gesture and movement might be particularly important for. My name is Chris Sharon, and I'm a doctoral student in ethics in Atlanta, Georgia. And I drew the proposal for conversation from this wonderful little book, Worship and Spirituality, which basically asks the question, how does worship shape us in our Christian life? And it engages that question through asking a number of different things. The introductory chapter, for instance, is about the contemporary debates about what style of worship we should have in our congregation. Contemporary worship, taze, should we have a traditional worship? So there's all sorts of discussions in this book, and one of the chapters deals with the hidden languages.
Is that book in the bookstore?
It's in the bookstore. And one of the hidden languages that Don Saliers considers are time, space, silence, and gesture and movement. The other book, obviously, from the practices that I'm using is the summer theme book, Practicing Our Faith. And so this, I'll start at the bottom with the hidden languages. The thesis really is that words and ideas are, of course, powerful and formative, and we often think about whether we agree or disagree with what someone says. But it's not so common for us to reflect on whether we agree or disagree or how we're affected by these hidden languages, by how ideas about time and practices of time and space and silence and gesture and movement shape us. And so I've made the proposal that these hidden languages form us, they shape us as well as what people might say to us. And that they especially shape us in liturgy. Liturgy, for the purposes of our conversation, I'm just suggesting that liturgy is a way to order our approach to God. You might have a not, quote, non-liturgical church, but nonetheless, most worship services, even Quaker services, which don't necessarily even have a bulletin or anything, tend to, over time in a particular community, take on a pattern. And so that's what I mean by liturgy. So this proposal really is that these hidden languages, for instance, the way that the architecture of the church building is, that space shapes us. And it shapes the way that we practice our faith, the way, for instance, that we would offer hospitality to guests. For instance, if we have a door that's hard to find on our church, that's a question of space that affects our ability to be hospitable to those who would visit our congregation. Are there comments or thoughts about this, questions about this general proposal before we move on. Does this make some sense, what I'm suggesting?
What is the list on the right?
The list on the right, those are the practices that are, that each have a chapter in this book. And so they're suggested as some of the practices that make up a Christian life, but I purposely left a space at the bottom for others because there are many other practices that make up living a Christian life that aren't included in the book, and the authors invite us to think together about what other practices are entailed in Christian living. So I invite you also to think about that. And one of the hopes I have is that we'll each bring from our own experience, our own life situation, our work, our communities, our congregation, examples, so that we can learn from each other in the process of exploring this question. Well, to begin with, let's just free associate for a minute about when you see gesture and particular movements in your daily life, or when you use gestures or specific types of movements in your daily life. A couple of things I thought of just off the top of my head to give you an idea of what I'm thinking about. Handshakes, a very common gesture, and going through some evolution now with different cultures and subgroups using variations of handshakes, high fives, and all sorts of mixed grips that shift as you're greeting someone. So that's one example. Another example that just came to me was the sorts of gestures you get on the freeway. I live in Atlanta, which has the largest daily commute in terms of miles per person of any city in the United States, and I see plenty of gesturing on the freeway. Are there other places? Those are obviously both gestures, but there's also particular kinds of movements that I'm sure you can think of. So what are some ideas that you have, things in your daily life that are common gestures or movements?
Other types of greetings, waving, you know.
Nodding your head to greet somebody.
Uh-huh.
Just making eye contact.
Sure. Body language, things like eye contact and nodding your head. I'm doing it right now without thinking about it. That's one of the things I hope that will...
I was thinking more nodding my head to somebody that is a greeting kind of
thing. Oh, yeah. When you see someone that you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
To acknowledge it. In our culture, though, a gesture and movement that you understand or heard is...
Right.
What we're doing.
Other things.
Well, the sort of the negative gesture, avoiding contact, is a movement that's used on that.
Yeah. Avoiding someone's eyes. That's sort of the opposite of eye contact. It carries meaning as well.
Mm-hmm. There's one. I moved to this town in California called Watsonville, and went there, and I was doing something, and suddenly someone said, "Oh, you know, turn around. You're giving your back to somebody."
Hmm.
And I didn't understand. And she said, "Well, here that means that's disrespectful." So that they were always trying to be on the outsides of the walls so that there was nobody behind them.
Hmm.
And it looked like they were all being wallflowers, but it was that everybody was supposed to be able to see everybody else's face.
Hmm.
And as a sign of respect.
Hmm.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah, that particularly would be interesting when you get to the, if you were thinking about how many churches are with pews one after the other,
mm-hmm.
almost everyone has people behind them.
Yeah.
I think queuing up or lining up is one of the most prevalent actions that our society participates in.
Yeah, we're some... Just free associate with that a little bit. Where are some places that we spend a lot of time waiting in line?
Grocery stores are the first one.
Grocery stores. Banks. ATM machine.
And there's great differences in the way people do that in different cultures, because we lived in Britain for a while, and people are much more polite and will not try to rush to the front. There's a real etiquette regarding standing in lines that is not observed in our culture.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, Mark even used the word queuing up, which I think is more
Written
up. How about sitting? We're all sitting right now. And it's not exactly, I mean, there's sort of a range of words you could use for what I'm trying to get at here, but it's sort of like bodily postures and gestures.
That's the way we're sitting.
Yeah. But sitting is a very, we spend a lot of time in our society sitting.
Or like teachers most of the time are standing.
Yeah.
While students are sitting.
Yeah.
I just thought of that, and you being seated.
So spell that out a little bit. What does the teacher standing in a classroom sitting down say?
It's a movement of authority, you know, and command central. Kind of. I mean, it's a disciplinary movement. I'm thinking in elementary schools where we're in my elementary school, we were all lined up in rows.
Mm-hmm.
The teacher was standing above us, mostly. And we stayed set in one place. Well, the teachers were the ones who moved around.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, just the question of how much movement you're allowed is an interesting question. For instance, at work, some people in certain work settings have more freedom of movement than others, or do more variety of movements than others. Like I was thinking of in Watsonville, the big industry is strawberries. Everywhere I go in the country, the strawberries are from Watsonville. And I think about the sort of day of a strawberry picker and the movements, and it just makes my back ache thinking about it. But that there are other jobs like that where the movements are similar all day long versus having a lot of diversity of movement. This opens up a different realm, the realm between men and women, but I couldn't help but think about gesture in relationship to all the stuff that's been going on for months and months and months in the White House, and questions about who said what and did what and what sorts of language, body language or gestures go on between men and women, and what constitutes sexual harassment, what constitutes appropriate interaction. Most often that sort of thing isn't straightforward verbal interaction. Oftentimes it's some sort of a gesture. So there's a whole layer of that sort of movement that impacts the relationship between men and women in our society.
I was thinking about dancing. I mean, the whole range of dancing styles that, you know, some that are very restrained and some are like, you know, I worked with African American youth, and, you know, I going to their prom was like almost, you know, embarrassing for me at times because it was so graphically sexual, you know, their dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that's their way, you know. It's interesting. And I think probably there would be a lot of Lutherans who would be uncomfortable with some of the rhythmic movement, you know, in African, like my African American Lutheran congregation, you know, just even to the music or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They might think it's sacrilege or something, or, you know.
Yeah, that's the difference in cult. That's like a similar thing to what Mike said, the difference between different cultures and
right,
ethnic groups, and how they use their bodies and move and gesture. One of my pastors and when I was in college, and a person who comes up here regularly, Dan Erlander, says that you can only tell when he's excited by the fact that he raises his left eyebrow, because he's a sort of a Swedish Lutheran who doesn't have a lot of expressiveness.
Well, an interesting thing about that is that that's, he may be saying this, that he isn't very expressive, but clearly that left eyebrow is very expressive.
Right.
And it's within the context of people like him, of his subculture,
right.
He's plenty expressive. He accomplishes, he communicates as he needs to with the people he needs to, and people can read what he does. I bring that up because as we get to talking about worship, that's clearly a problem. Where some people say, well, for instance, you white people are so stiff. You don't have any heart. You don't have any soul. You don't have any expressiveness. You know. But you know, in my hometown back in Minnesota, I never knew that I was so stiff.
Yeah.
Because everyone else moved the same way I did.
Yeah.
And so, I mentioned that with treading on politically incorrect ground, but that is a, I think, a real problem in our church right now. We speak too many gestural languages, and we don't read one another's. So that to say, I'm not very expressive, or you aren't very expressive, is getting lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in a sense, what he's offering by saying, he says that often, I'm excited now, you can tell because my left eyebrow is raised. He's giving people clues about how to read his style of expressing himself,
And that's helpful, frankly.
Yeah.
Until you know, it's like a choir director. Every one of them has a different style of directing, and you have to learn it before you can respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've sung under so many different choir directors over the years that it's gotten to be the point where you have to at least spend 2 or 3 weeks trying to figure out what it is they're trying to tell you to do.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing is true in relationships. I was a missionary in South America, and I found out there were some gestures that I could no longer use because to them it meant something totally different than what we knew. But A-OK here meant something horrific down there.
Yeah.
They did it down there.
Yeah.
It was like flipping somebody off, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. And so you had to be really careful. And so then you got to be almost gestureless for a while until you could figure out exactly what you were to allow to do.
I find that in the city too, that I'm more reluctant to just sort of make random gestures because there's such a diversity of people and subcultures in big urban areas that I'm not sure how it's going to be interpreted. Especially if I'm driving, I never take my hands off the steering wheel when I'm driving because I don't, you know, I could itch my ear and someone could interpret that in a way that is negative.
I have a friend who works for the state and drives a state car, and they were given an instruction recently that you are to never, never, ever look at anybody when you're driving. Never glance over and catch somebody's glance when you're driving a state car because it could make them angry.
Hmm.
I thought that was an interesting statement. I thought, whoa.
Well, we've had a number of people comment in the direction of what we do in worship. So let's shift gears and suggest some things that we do in worship in terms of gesture and movement. And I want to suggest that although I've talked about these other hidden languages, that the primary hidden language in worship is our body and our bodies together as the body of Christ. And so I think particularly when we join together in worship, it's important to think about body language, about gesture and movement, because of that central aspect, gathered together, we are the body of Christ. And you could say, for instance, that the church's involvement in mission or the church's involvement in some community activity is body language. It's a gesture. So there's a real importance in thinking carefully about how we're formed in worship, to think about our bodies. Something in Western Christianity that we haven't been so good at. Oftentimes worrying a lot about souls and spirits and not talking so much about body. So I'd like to think about this on a couple of levels. First, I wanted to think together about baptism and communion, sort of the two central sacramental actions that make up worship life. And
Hi. There's, you can sit over there, but there's also space over here. You're welcome to come.
This is fine.
Okay.
I apologize for coming in late.
It's fine. Let's think about baptism first. What gestures and movements are a part of baptism?
People come to the front, in front of us.
They come up front?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a movement to a different space?
Mm-hmm.
Some churches, they go to the back now. Baptismal font is at the back of the church as you enter it.
Yeah.
And some of them are big, huge fonts.
Yeah.
So we have to leave this space to go to the baptism. Or they do it as you enter the church.
Yeah. The common theme would be going wherever the mm-hmm. wherever the font is in the worship space.
In my church, it's the one time that we as a whole congregation remember our baptisms, because the baptismal font is rolled up to the front. And we pass it as we go to the altar, and that's the one time that we're, as a community, remember our baptism.
How do you remember your baptisms with your bodies? Do you do any particular?
Sitting in the water and making the sign of the cross.
On your forehead?
Yeah, and it's always sitting outside at in the narthex, but not a lot of people do remember their baptism. It's only when it's literally in front of them that they do that.
Yeah.
In my church, they invite the children to come up and sit around and watch the baptism. And I think it's also a sort of a reminder for them as well. And it's sort of a way to make kids feel more part of the church and maybe get them accustomed to some of the rituals that we have.
So it's a sort of a teaching movement
mm-hmm.
to show, not necessarily explaining it all, but showing them, giving them a front row view.
Right.
Yeah.
In our church, we take a picture of water and pass it through the pews. Huh. So everyone put their hands in the pitcher, remembering their baptism,
uh-huh.
and blessing the water as it passes through the congregation before it gets poured into a bowl.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
What sorts of meanings do you associate with that? That sounds powerful to me.
Really?
It's remembering your own baptism.
Yeah.
And hearing the sound of the water when you splash.
Yeah.
So that's an important piece of that.
Yeah.
It's a sense in which I think we're all participant in the baptism, where typically I think it's looked at as the pastor and the person being baptized, the only participants,
right.
So we all participate in that and join in that.
Yeah. That's a nice symbolism of the church as the body participating together. That's nice.
I noticed the other night here when we moved from one room to the other, when she poured the water in the font, she did it very slowly, so that there's a lot of sound.
Uh-huh.
And in my home church, they do that as well. They have a carved stone font so that you're very struck with the water is alive.
Yeah.
It isn't static. It really is living water.
Right.
A similar thing is done in our congregation. We pour the water into the pitcher, and it splashes all over everybody standing next to it. We bring the entire family of the person being baptized to surround the baptismal font behind it, and the entire congregation doesn't move, but they surround it from the other side, and so the person that's being baptized is totally surrounded by people, by the body of Christ, and they participate in lots of different ways. We have them pronounce a blessing over the person being baptized as well, using the Aaronic blessing, and oftentimes they'll raise their hands in a sign of blessing to the person as well.
That's another use of the hands in general, but for blessings, for crossing the forehead, for sticking in the water as the pitcher goes around, for actually doing the movement of pouring the water. And a number of those movements, you would find analogies in our society in general, but a number of them, no. For instance, pouring a pitcher is one that you would find elsewhere. But the pitcher going through the congregation and everyone touching the water is unique. And the crossing the water on the forehead. So there are some gestures associated, movements associated with baptism that shape us differently than our society shapes us. So that's important to pay attention to. Let's think for a moment about a Holy Communion, and some of the body participation that's involved in Holy Communion. Obviously, you eat and you drink, so some very common human actions, but there are other things as well.
Either you're standing in line.
Yeah.
Or kneeling, too.
Kneeling?
Yeah. I also think of serving, too. I mean, many of us have probably given up the bread and the wine. I think it's a really, it's a meaningful act, I think, for the speaker as well, to be able to do that. I enjoy doing that sort of thing that I want to.
And making eye contact with the person giving me the, I've never served, but, you know, eye contact with the person who's giving me the sacrament.
Yeah. How do you receive with your, what do you do with your hand?
This is what I do.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about that. Can anyone think of other times in their daily life when they walk up to someone with their hands cupped like this and
it's a beggar's
and receive post. Something?
It's a beggar's.
Yeah, it is. It's a beggar's pose. And I couldn't think of another example where I ever do that.
As children, adults were passing out candy, or
right.
If you would do that.
Right. So it's sort of... Although, if Halloween is any indication, it's more like this.
You know, that's an interesting thing I was thinking about in terms of gesture at communion, because the adults, they're all very polite, and they do this.
Uh-huh.
But the kids, I want some.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm wondering about the expression that they're making when they're grabbing and desiring it, you know, so obviously, versus a desire which is in a way less evident because it's not, this isn't a desirous motion in our culture, you know,
right.
When we do this, or it is, I guess, today, but it's a waiting,
right.
It's a patient kind of desire.
I wonder if that's partly like, you know, I just remember I couldn't wait to have communion, you know, like when I got in fourth grade and knew that in fifth grade I would get first communion or whatever. And it, to me, it was a really big deal to get it, you know, and it still is, but it's much more, you know, just a matter of course now. You know? And for kids, it's like something newer. I mean, I think that's part of it, maybe a little bit. It was for me, that eagerness, that... excitement about it and kind of entering into the big people's world. You know?
Yeah, I see this grabbing gesture with my daughter, who's 8 months old, and her mom is getting some bread. So she's grabbing for the bread too, saying, oh, I get some too, don't I?
Yeah. Can I learn something from that?
I found another place where I held my hands this way. So if somebody has some M&Ms.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You don't want to drop one.
Yes.
But as you were talking about the kids, that's not how our daughter would do it. Her hand would be going in the back. She would have waited to have her forward.
Yeah. Are there other movements or gestures with communion before we move on that strike you?
There's the blessing, you know, the pastoral blessing at the end.
In our church, we encourage people to carry their children with them. And those that don't receive communion, they all receive a blessing from the pastor or from the server.
Yeah.
And so there's that motion in our church where we place our hand on their head and again make the sign of the cross on their forehead just to remind them of who they are and whose they are.
Yeah. Connection between baptism and
right.
communion. That's good. A movement that I think has some profound implications for Christians and economics is the fact that all come and receive at the table. It's not, you know, for those in the front three rows or for the people who have designer label tie or anything.
Whose dues are paid.
Yeah, whose dues are paid. All can receive. So there's an important movement in that. Well, I would like to take that and just spread it out a little bit more broadly in worship and think about what movement and gesture we participate in the worship service in general.
Well, in the liturgical church, we do a lot of standing and sitting. And those have significance in the liturgical service.
Yeah. Like, for instance, what would be a real significant standing?
Standing for the gospel to acknowledge the presence of God and the Spirit as that is delivered to us.
Yeah. So standing as a means of giving honor.
Yeah.
And
what's interesting, I think, is when like the first row or something stands up, everybody stands up, or if just a few people stand up and they look around, everybody's sitting down, they sit right back down. So it's like you can't, it's, I think that's a really interesting movement thing that everybody has to be not cohesive, what's
in the same.
I was in worship once where the singing of the hymns, people asked, do we stand or we sit, depending on the congregation, and where the presider asked people to take a moment during the during the organist's introduction of the hymn to read through the verses and to pick which of the four verses they were going to stand on.
Wow.
And so they would stand on the verse that they wanted to stand on and sit for the other three. And it had some special meaning, and so they were all standing and sitting down. It was really, you know, people were going, oh, that, you like that verse better. I wonder why, you know? And,
at least they were probably more conscious of the words. You know?
Yeah,
that's true. If you have to make a decision that's going to be a public action, you know, you better look at those words.
Yeah. I can't do that.
That's great. And it takes advantage of people's understanding that in worship you stand up for something when it's important to you.
Right.
It's not a common practice, but one of the most meaningful worship experiences I've ever had was here when we were guests during the week that hearing impaired were here. Mm. And during communion, we did the Taizé hymn, Come Holy Spirit, Veni Spiritus Sanctus.
Uh-huh.
Only everyone was signing it.
Yeah.
And it was, it just electric. I mean, it's, the whole body was moving.
And in a way that included those who are often marginalized.
Yes.
So there's a powerful layer there with that as well. Yeah.
I think it says a lot about a church, too, that does have hearing impaired, a signer for hearing impaired, whether or not there are hearing impaired people in the congregation that day, that there is still someone doing it. I always would look at the signer, especially during the Lord's Prayer. One of the most powerful things was a sign for forgiveness. It's like a wiping clean, and I've never forgotten that.
Huh.
I just thought that was so powerful to see that. So the movement, whether or not it's a form of communication which you use all the time, is so important to see.
Yeah.
It's really powerful.
And it sounds like for many people it adds a layer of meaning that simply the words don't necessarily get across. Another example of all doing something together, I find it extremely powerful when the whole group kneels together, because as the receiving gesture, all kneeling together is a movement which I think is very uncommon. I mean, it's actually weird. A whole group of people all in a room together kneeling. I mean, where else could you go and see that? It's a very powerful movement. And it may not, but it may help the community later in the week, an individual later in the week, when they need to have a disposition of kneeling, when they need to, that one of the things I think happens when the community does these movements together over time is that they learn things that they don't necessarily use all the time, but at certain times need to know how to do, need to know how to wait and receive, need to know how to kneel in a sort of penitential mode to ask for forgiveness. So there's an aspect of this gesture and movement that trains us or schools us in
certain ways that I think are very important, and we're hearing those from the witnesses in your comments. Are there other things from the liturgy as a whole, from the worship as a whole, that occurred to you?
You know, that you just right now look like that. Mm-hmm. And you earlier did that too. And those are all those old paintings of Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, where Jesus stands like this. Yeah. And we had one hanging by our kitchen table, so I always remember that. I know it's got so many different. The first thing, if you just go like that and see it through your. It's a cross.
Right.
It's a cross, and yet it's also welcoming.
Right.
It also is whole, like you were saying.
Yeah.
It encompasses the whole thing. It's a totally non-threatening gesture, because you're laying yourself, whoever's making the gesture is laying themselves open to whatever comes.
Right.
I've been fascinated by that gesture, because as a singer, choral conductor, you usually, when you conduct, you use both hands like this. And when you do this, you get a different sound out of your group.
Huh. Interesting.
And one of the greatest choral conductors, well, in the world, I guess, but in our country certainly, Robert Shaw, conducts frequently like this, with both of his hands out here at the side. And I've watched him doing that and thinking, that Shaw sound, which is so rich and full and velvety, I think comes because of this gesture. That somebody that conducts here narrowly gets a thin, focused, in tune, but somehow non-inclusive sound.
Huh.
This gives a more, well, I'm going off too far maybe, but that gesture gets used a lot more in church than it does anywhere else. And I always have this vision from my childhood of that painting and then going to church. And our pastor loved, he was a big fat guy, stand in front of the church like this, welcoming people as they came to church in the morning, before church.
Yeah.
He'd stand there like that, right in the door, sort of blocking the door. And yet you didn't feel blocked. I mean, it was very nice. I have very good memories.
There's a level of that that's helpful, because it says that our bodily integrity says either what our words are saying, or our bodily movement can say something different than what our words are saying. So that's something that we learn through that sort of modeling participation as well. So I wonder if there are any people who either raise their hands or particularly oriented towards that sort of praise as, not as presiders, but just as worshipers, and what that experience is like for them.
At my church, when we say the Lord's Prayer, when we get to the kingdom, everybody's holding hands, and we all raise our hands, and I'm to the point where, like, you know, even praying it here, like, I have this urge to raise my hands at the end, and it really, like, adds a lot of power to the ending of the prayer for me. It's pretty cool. But yeah, and that whole thing of, like, kind of testifying and putting your hand in the air, that happens in my church too, on occasion.
Yeah.
It's funny you say that. I'm sure that is very, very powerful, but at our church, I think somebody would probably have a stroke.
Different styles.
Yeah.
What sorts of ways do you, I mean, are there visible ways that people express?
Stoic. It's probably traditional Missouri Synod, as far as I know. So.
Even the passing of the peace is difficult,
I had there was a woman in the congregation I served in my early years in seminary who didn't like holding hands with other people during the prayers, because she was always nervous she would catch cold from someone touching someone else's hand. So that, on the one hand, is humorous, but on the other hand, it raises the issue that, you know, human beings are human beings, and there's all sorts of reasons why people either are into a particular movement or don't like doing a particular movement. So even within one congregation, I think there's much variety in the way people participate in the gesture movement and find it meaningful. Well, this is a rich selection of gestures and movements and experiences that all of us have had. And I think we found
that there certainly are some things that we do in worship that are characteristic of worship and of Christian gatherings that shape us in particular ways, and some congregations in ways different than other congregations. But nonetheless, let's take a minute and think about, now that we've got before us all these different ideas about gesture and movement in worship, how do you think some of these practices, whether you've read the book or not, I think some of these are straightforward enough. How are gesture and movement necessary for doing some of these practices well? I think right off the top, the story that Bruce was telling about the gesture of welcome like this, it would be very difficult to be hospitable without hospitable body language. In whatever style that is for you, it may be just preparing well so the table is set and things are prepared so the guests feel like they're welcome. Or it may be sort of an effervescent personality that makes people feel welcome. But certainly there are things that are done to make the guests feel welcome.
In our church, there are people, lay people, who always welcome people as they are coming into the narthex, the upper narthex, to go into the room. And then afterwards it's the pastor welcoming, you know, greeting. I like the welcoming congregation members. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when visitors are there and everything.
I think you bring up a good thing. Who's doing the gestures is really important. In some congregations that I've worshipped in, only the men are the ushers. Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of implied responsibility that men have in that congregation that women don't. Or then you wonder, well, then there's other things that women do. Women are the ones who are pouring the coffee after coffee hour at that congregation. And so there's how depending on which gender you are, which kinds of offerings of hospitality you get to provide. Mm-hmm. Or the pastor or the lay people greeting people at the beginning of worship. Mm-hmm. And what message that sends to a visitor.
I think that's really true. This is not worship, but I was an usher at a friend's wedding once, and there were four of us women who were ushers, and people really had a hard time with that. They didn't. They're like, well, what do we call you, an usherette or something? Do I have to take your arm? No, I'll just walk you to your seat. They really were taken aback by that. And a lot of them just joked about it, but you could tell that some of them were really uncomfortable. Not because it was so weird, but it was just something different that they had never thought about before.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how those gender things can seep into your brain without even knowing it.
In our discussion this morning, we talked about what it's like to be single in a congregation. And we talked about someone mentioned that they had gone and asked to be a greeter, and there was a single woman in the congregation, and the woman said, well, how could you do that? You don't have a husband. And she said, well, I could bring a friend. And the woman was surprised, and she thought, well, why not? And so now there's two women standing, or maybe a man and a woman, I don't know who her friend was, but it's changed the way the congregation does it. And I've noticed I've been in my congregation for 10 years, and I've noticed there's been a change in our congregation from when I came. It was always a married couple at the door, at every entrance that we had, and now we have widows, one at a time, we have singles, one at a time, we have. And that happened without me doing anything about it, even though I am the singles minister of the congregation. Mm-hmm. But I think awareness had been raised. Anyway, I found that to be an interesting. It's a different movement in the church, I guess, too.
That's right.
And being more inclusive.
Right, and some of these comments have brought up the fact that we can have practices that malform us, that shape us in ways that we actually don't like so much, and we take a moment together and think about, well, is this how we hope our life would be together? So sometimes exactly that in a congregation can open up all sorts of wonderful new possibilities. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at with this question of what forms us well. And partly I think what needs to happen is exactly that sort of discussion and saying, well,
what are we trying to offer here, hospitality? Well, what does it take to do that? And what are the limitations that we've imposed? Are they necessary?
And what does it say if we do only offer one sort of thing?
Right.
Or what are we saying to a single population or a Hispanic population if we don't, you know, if there are Hispanic people in our congregation and we, none of them usher,
right.
Or if there are people of other color, or gender too.
Right. All of these things that we're talking about bear just as directly on the practice of shaping community. And Larry Rasmussen in that chapter talks exactly about the problematics of leadership and who's leading which part, some of the questions that both you and the other Mike brought up. Other practices that you think require a certain sort of gesture or movement, either that may be related to what we do in worship?
I'm thinking about offering.
Uh-huh.
And it, I mean, I haven't been in a church yet where the plate is always passed.
Yeah.
Instead of making them, and then it's taken up as a community offering. It's not any kind of individual offerings.
Yeah.
And then, but you, in your church experience, it's always been brought forward by someone?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
See, our Easter Sunrise service has, for a number of years, been in the Black Baptist Church in our community, and there the tradition is that the basket is in front of the pulpit, and everyone marches up and helps it in.
It's a processional offering. We do that on occasion, too.
Yeah.
Several times a year, especially if it's a mission offering or whatever.
Right, make it more visible.
Yeah. And
it's
a powerful movement toward the altar again, toward the presence of God.
Yeah.
And it takes effort on your part, because for some people it's a very uncomfortable movement to walk up with their... We have a processional offering. We gather pennies, nickels, and dimes for world hunger. And we have a big, huge wheelbarrow in front of our church. And by the time the third service is over on Sunday morning, that wheelbarrow is overflowing with pennies, nickels, dimes, because people have been saving them all year long. And we sometimes get $3,000 worth of pennies, nickels, and dimes in this wheelbarrow. And but these people come up and they pour this money in, and then it's offered up in this wheelbarrow, I guess, full of money, just as a to show that even the stuff that we consider a nuisance can make a real difference in the lives of people.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking on a similar note, my brother's church, they have at the offering time the children, there are some cups up front, and the children go get the cups and walk around and collect everyone's change, and then they go up and stand on a chair or a little ladder thing and pour it into a long tube, and they can, you know, you can see how the tube is coming, and that money also goes to other programs or whatever. And it just is such a glorious image to see these little children coming around, and they get to pour it in, and they're so excited, and that's really cool.
We even use a gesture, sort of an act thing. We, during Advent, we collect quarters for World Hunger too, and we call it Quarterback Sunday. And we have two people from the football team wearing their uniforms, gathering these quarters and taking them up to the operator. It kind of sounds hokey, but it people look forward to it. One year we chose not to do it because we thought it was just getting old hat. And people said, where are the quarterbacks?
Yeah.
You know? And it gives them, it's something to help them remember, too. It's a visual, I guess.
Yeah.
But I got a real kick out of it. The first time we did it, I thought, well, we've never done this. But people enjoyed it rather than yelled at me, so it was
right.
Okay.
That's good.
I was thinking about singing too, and just like, you know, again, it's such a cultural, you know, there's so many styles of singing in worship, and how much gesture becomes involved in that, in movement.
Oh,
really varies.
I keep talking too much here, but even like the first night that I was here, we had I don't know what the gospel service or whatever you want to call it. And I was fascinated. I was one of the singers, and so that was fun for me because I love to sing. But we moved, and as soon as we started moving, the entire congregation came to life.
Yeah.
They started moving themselves. They and there was one place where we went an octave jump, and you should have seen the faces of the people as we sang. I mean, we went this octave jump, and it was beautiful, and these people were going, wow! I mean, it was just like the excitement of the whole moment. It was just a lifting of people's faces and the entire mood of the... I mean, music changes the people's expression. And when it's really good, people respond physically to it.
Right.
And when we clapped, they clapped. When we swayed, they swayed.
Yeah.
And some of us couldn't clap and sway at the same time, but they know each other.
You mentioned earlier some difficulty with sharing the piece. And I think I make a connection between these things. For somebody like my mother and her parents and grandparents who, you know, live in small town Minnesota and are as Norwegian as they can be, I mean, these people don't even cook with garlic.
Right.
But the fact is, they think unseasoned food tastes good.
Yeah, that's right.
And they're not eating a purposefully bland diet. They don't think that dull is better. They don't think they have a dull life. In fact, they may be tasting things that people that eat spices all the time don't taste. And I think that has a lot to do with this, everybody hugs each other during the sharing of the peace. My mother would never hug a soldier in public. Sharing of the peace, you know, a very polite handshake. But that does not represent a cold heart.
No.
And that's her background, and that... In the current movement in our church, people like her and her traditions are being buried. People are saying, that's old, that's old-fashioned, that's so white bread, that's so stiff, that's so cold. And my mother would love to have somebody sing, you know, a plain old, like, Den Store Vi de Flock or something like that at her funeral that no one sways to, no one snaps their fingers to.
Right.
And it doesn't have less meaning to her
right.
because of that. It doesn't have less meaning because it's not on an electrified instrument. It doesn't come through a microphone. I think that as we're going through these changes in our culture and in our church, we've got to stop making value judgments like that. We people who find ourselves on maybe that side of the divide have got to be a little bit prouder of our background and our heritage too when it comes to gesture. And there's nothing wrong with me if I don't hug every single person within reach during the sharing of the peace. It doesn't mean I don't like them.
How did you even need to shake a hand? You wouldn't need to. You could look at somebody and say, good morning, the peace of God be with you. I think that we need to respect all of us need to respect each other in whatever we're comfortable with and however we find worship meaningful, you know?
Yeah,
yeah. And because I'm a Swedish, you know, and the handshake isn't that easy for me either. You know, I mean, I do it, and I do the handshake, and, you know, it seems a little programmed or stiff or something, you know? But what's to say? I agree with you. I really agree with you. There's no better or worse here. There's no good or bad in the way we do worship if it includes those who are there, you know?
And I think some of the responsibility has to come back to the individual person when they are a member of the church. Just thinking of my own experience is that recognizing what you need as an individual and finding that place. And, you know, it's not necessarily that you have to leave a congregation that you've been in, but if you see that it is that your needs aren't being met and the congregation is growing in a different way than you need, then reconciling that within yourself and then searching for yourself, is there another place for you to be, or is there something that you can do within the congregation to meet your needs? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really that we as individuals have to take on some of that responsibility of being a layperson, of getting our own needs met, and not leave it up to the pastors always to try and please everybody. Mm-hmm. It's become some of our responsibility.
Yeah.
Let's take this example, though, that's been circulating here of controversy about different styles of doing worship, and ask the question, if you were going to have a discussion among a group of different people about different styles of sharing the peace, for instance, is there some practice of gesture, worship practice, that you would include in that discussion at the beginning, say, some sort of ritual moment that would help people move towards a posture of openness and humility in the discussion? Is there something from our tradition that you would draw on to set a stage for real openness and listening?
I think that's a really profound question. I think it's a big deal.
I think you'd have to go back to the scriptures and take a look at Jesus' actions and how were discussions about practices that he was doing that was against or not politically correct during his time,
yeah.
And how did he address those things? So I would, for me, that would have to be a starting place for a group, is to start to look at that kind of study.
One of the things that we've done, our congregation has become a large congregation, and we've begun to lose community.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've begun a discussion sort of thing, but they've set ground rules. They've worked hard and prayed hard and studied the scriptures to try to figure out how it is that we can politely work together and bring out common concerns as a congregation, because there are some in our midst that were less than polite, and
right.
Very difficult for other people to even voice their opinion
right.
as a result. And so that's been an interesting thing. I never thought I'd see some of those rules of order be necessary,
right.
but in our congregation it has kind of become that way.
Well, it's very, along those lines, it's very interesting. In the chapter on discernment, the author outlines two historic models in the Christian tradition of setting out some ground rules for moving through a process of conflict and listening and hearing and coming to some resolution. One is from the Quakers, and that practice is an intentional commitment to sit and quiet and listening. And as discussion happens and disagreement happens, a commitment to stay and to sit and listen some more and wait. And that out of that, they believe the Spirit will bring consensus, will bring an answer that all can agree on. And the other model that he talks about is an Ignatian model, a model not of consensus, but of a rigorous thinking through together of the options, and not only thinking about the options that I want, but first, before I think about that, thinking through very carefully and in a real extended way what it would be like if I were to live out the option I don't like, what that would be like, so that I train myself to be able to think in a hospitable way toward the person who's differing from me. So there's some real interesting issues at stake in how a community sort of ritualizes disagreement or figures out a way together to move through disagreement. And I think some of these gestures and movements can really help us in our ability to speak together.
It's very interesting, as we brought those ground rules out, the ones who were most vocal and the most difficult really were angry and fought against them.
Huh. Interesting.
Really angry because their time was limited, and that was part of it.
Yeah.
Their audience was limited, and they didn't like being limited.
Yeah.
They felt that it was very fascinating. The anger was very palatable.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've often thought about the use of Latin in the Roman Catholic Church historically.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of how it got started, the fact is that as the Roman Catholic Church spread out worldwide, the thing that all those cultures, all those peoples, all those body languages had in common was the Roman Catholic liturgy in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And there were good reasons for the Catholic Church to drop that, for sure. I understand. But nonetheless, it functioned as a common language for people from many diverse cultures to be able to worship together, to have a common ground of understanding.
Did people actually understand what they were saying?
Well, that's why there are a lot of questions about it, and I think I can understand why they stopped doing it.
Because I'm just wondering if it's really a language if you don't understand what you're saying.
But I think that for the Mass itself, you know, the words, the ordinary of the Mass, I think most people finally hearing that for several years, they know what that means. And they knew what it meant in South Africa, and they knew what it meant in Germany, and they knew what it meant in Japan, and wherever they were, they knew. I'm not asking for a return to the Latin Mass. I'm saying if there were some correlative to that we could come up with gesturally as a way of worship, something that could be understood and acknowledged across different cultures, that would be a magical thing. It would be a very grace-filled sort of a thing to have. I know that at that same time, the Roman Catholic Church was saying there is a kind of music that is appropriate for worship, and that this music was being disseminated by the Church in the 16th and 17th century throughout, you know, Europe at any rate, saying that this we believe is appropriate music for worship. Well, you know, you get into trouble that way. You do. I understand that, but the fact is it lasted a long time and was very successful for a long time. In some ways.